I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Mildred. Hi, everybody. I should really have said, my name is Mildred, and we are alcoholic. Because I think that what Paul was saying last night about the voices in his head certainly applies to me. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for allowing me the privilege of being here this weekend. Rarely do I get the opportunity to spend a weekend with a fellow Humboldtonian, Al, in other words, and that has been a great pleasure, and it certainly was a great pleasure to be here with Paul and with Max and Gloria, and to be back in Thunder Bay. I love this city, and I would like to thank Ain for his kind hospitality. He's chauffeured me around and gave me a tour of the city yesterday. And I'd like to thank the committee, too, for their hospitality and for their kindness and for your friendliness. Some people try to tell me that the further west you move from Toronto, the friendlier the people get. I'm sure you know that that isn't true, because we're really very friendly in Toronto if you get to know us. I love the city. It's where I got sober, and I guess because I got sober there, I think you always have a special place in your heart for the place where you came to. And that's really where I began to be glad that I was alive, and that was an experience that I had never had before. I sometimes, you know, say to myself, what am I doing at these meetings? What does anybody invite me to come and speak at a meeting for? And, you know, when I was first new in the program, I thought speakers had some kind of special something that nobody else had. And I don't believe that anymore, because I'm just an ordinary member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to share with you what my life was like, what I was like, to share with you, because I think that's one of the ways that change comes about. I have never changed because somebody has lectured to me and said, you must do this. I think this is one of the miracles of AA, that we, whoever it is, whether it be myself or whether it be you at a meeting or whether it be you at this podium, when you stand here, you don't stand as an authority as I don't stand as an authority. I'm just a person working my way through life, trying to be a little better today than I was yesterday, trying to be a little more successful, to feel a little more at home in this universe, trying to be less a victim and less self-defeating than I was yesterday. And how this process is going on in my life today is what I'm here to share with you. If you don't like what I say, and you don't like the way I think, that's your prerogative. And I won't even say I give you the privilege to be wrong, because you may be very right, and you probably are very right for you. What has happened in my life is my experience. And if, as I said, you don't like what I say, you know, try to have mercy on me and remember that I'm only one person who speaks. There are lots of other people whom you may relate to much better than you relate to me. And so somebody will come along. I've heard it said if you stay around this program long enough, the person will come along who will tell your story. The person will come along that you need to hear. And so, because I have a rather unique story, I guess, in one sense, I'm just a normal human being, but if you find it difficult to identify with my being in a convent, for example, I don't blame you for that, but try to see the similarities between what I'm going to say and where you are in life, and maybe then we can share something with each other. I'm glad to be alive this morning for a lot of reasons. That was not always so. And I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm not proud of that fact, but I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic. I used to think that some people came into this world and their lives went okay, and that somehow or other, it just went okay. They never really had to pay the same kind of price that I had to pay. I believe today that everybody has paid the price for wherever they are in life. I used to think, too, that being an alcoholic was either, for a while, I thought it was a curse, and for a while, I thought it was a blessing. I don't know which it is, Except for me, I know that I'm grateful that if I had to pay a price for the good life, that it was alcoholism. I know people who have inoperable cancer. I teach kids who have multiple sclerosis and who have various other kinds of disabilities that makes it very difficult for them to live a normal life. And I'm glad that I have what I've got, because at some point I learned that if I want to control my illness, not cure it, just control it, all I really have to do is put the cork on the bottle and leave it there. And then go about the business of dedicating myself to coming to a couple of meetings a week, dedicating myself to a couple of hours, and doing what I ought to do anyway, which is normally to change and try to lead a decent life. And that's the only price, really, that I have to pay for the privilege of standing upright today and knowing that I belong on the face of the earth and that I'm okay and holding my head high and not having to feel ashamed that I exist. So I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm certainly proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I must say that is the best thing that has come into my life. And if you feel that I'm strange and maybe should go to a funny farm because I say I'm proud to be an AA, I can assure you that I'm no stranger to funny farms, having been incarcerated at one or another across this country at least 29 times that I can count, from periods ranging from 5 days to 5 months. And while I was there, sometimes by my own will, sometimes by the will of others, they diagnosed me as being schizoid, as having a schizophrenic personality, as being a schizophrenic, as being schizoid paranoid, paranoid schizoid. That sounded good. They said that I was manic depressive depressed and manic depressive manic. And I don't know, I suppose you can keep on with the diagnoses. They gave them about all to me. So by the time some man came into my life and said, "We think you're an alcoholic," that was very good news indeed. I have a brother who is in Alcoholics Anonymous who came in Humboldt in about the year 1952-53. And so I knew that he who had been the town drunk and the black sheep of the family was now sober. And I knew that something wonderful had happened to him. So when this man said to me, "Would you go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And this was back in 1966. And if you can count, you know that I have only 15 years of sobriety, so the first time it sure didn't stick. But I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous kind of the way this story goes. It seems that this drunk was going home through the graveyard one night, and it was raining, and he fell into this newly dug grave, and he tried to claw his way out. And the more he tried to claw his way out, the more he kept slipping back into the grave, and finally, in despair of getting out that night, he thought, "I'll just sit here, and tomorrow morning when they come to put the stiff in, they'll let me out first." So he sat in the corner of the grave, and while he was sitting there, a second drunk came through the graveyard, and he too fell in. And by this time, drunk number one was sitting in the corner, kind of dozing, muttering to himself, not too aware of what was happening. And drunk number two tried the same thing. He too tried to get out of the grave, and he couldn't. But he kept clawing his way up, and finally, drunk number one in the corner stood up, and kind of bleary-eyed, he walked over to drunk number two, and he tapped him on the shoulder. And he said, "You're not going to get out of here." And he did. And that's kind of the way I came to the program. Not because I wanted to, but out of sheer desperation. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I was like. I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan, and I hated every minute of that. And I was German, and I was ashamed of that, because I was, 5 or 6 when the war was starting, and it wasn't very popular to be German at that time. I was the youngest of a family of 10, and I thought that was obscene. I didn't like being Roman Catholic, and I sure didn't like being a girl. Other than that, everything was just great. I can remember sitting there at my sister's wedding at 3 years old, and I just remember this flash in, standing there thinking, "What am I doing on the face of the earth? I don't want to be here." I didn't like my family. I didn't like the circumstances in which I was. I felt lonely. I felt alienated. I felt alone. And I just wished that it hadn't all happened. If you had asked me at about 16 what I wanted, I would have told you that the best thing that could happen to me was to get cancer. Because I thought if I could just get cancer, I could die. People would feel sorry for me, and I wouldn't be in the terrible position that I'm in today. Sick, isn't it? I know. But that's the way I felt. I was not a happy person, as you can imagine. That's why I'm so grateful to this program, because I've learned to laugh here. When I was sober about 5 years, my sponsor took me aside one time, and he said, God, he said, you know how to work, he said, and you know how to do the things you need to do. But he said, I wish you wouldn't be so glum. He said, you got to learn to smile and enjoy life. And he was right. I didn't know how to enjoy life. Convents in those days weren't big on enjoyment. They weren't big on partying, and they weren't big on this business of relating to other people and really enjoying life. The convent, however, was not my problem. I went there in 1951 as a means, I think, of running away from life. Goodness knows there's nothing wrong with having babies and making gardens and looking after a household if that's what you want to do. My sisters are quite normal, and so was my mother, and they were quite happy to live in, to do those things. But me, I used to sit there like a caged lion, and I would think, where do I want to be? What would it take to make me happy? And unfortunately, I couldn't have told you what it would take to make me happy. And so at 18, I decided that I would go to the convent. And I could talk, you know, a long time about that, but I won't. I think I was running away, and I think I was making a bargain with God, because I thought, if I do the hardest thing that I can think of, I'm going to sacrifice my life, and somehow or other, God is going to give me happiness. He's going to make it all okay. And I guess in the long run, that's really ultimately what happened. It didn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen, but it did happen. I was drunk the night I entered, and I kind of set the convent on their ears. I went to Waterdown, Ontario, and thinking that I was going to a very swinging convent. And what I didn't know was that I was going to a convent that was almost semi-cloistered. They told me that if I didn't want to be there, that I would give all the greater glory to God, and so I stayed. I stayed, and I know now that I was already an alcoholic. And so the 15 years that I spent there, I was drunk a good portion of the time that I was in there. And nobody would confront that. And they knew it. You know, after I left, it's amazing what you find out once something ends. After I left, I found out that they knew all about what was going on in my life, that I was dragging pills into the convent, that I was dragging booze into the convent, that I was dragging booze to the bell tower of the church, and God knows what. But nobody ever said anything to me about it, because I was an enigma. I worked hard. I always did about the work of three nuns at any given time, because I was strong, I was healthy, I was talented, and I think I had to justify my drinking, and so that's what I did. My father died in 1965, and I went home to Humboldt. I think Al described that town to you on Friday night. In my long black gown, drunk at my father's funeral, I can assure you I was not low profile. I thought that I had a good reason, sorrowing at the death of my father. When I got back to Ontario, Mother Superior called me in, and we had a chat, and she said to me, would you like to leave? And I said, of course I'd like to leave. I never wanted to be here. And she said, well, I don't really like to see you go, but she said, I think maybe you're young enough. I was 33 at the time, and just so you won't have to do the mathematics on your fingers and toes, I'm 55 now. And this was in the fall of 1965. And she said to me, we'll write to Rome, and we did. And I well remember January the 10th, 1966, standing on the convent steps. Bear in mind that I had studied psychology, philosophy, theology. We had spent approximately 6 hours a day in spiritual exercises in the convent. And I stood on the convent steps that day thinking that my problems were over. incredible, isn't it, that you can be 33 years of age, have had all that training and all that information and all that background and all that experience, and not know that your problems are inside yourself, that it is not circumstances and the Pope and the Church and the nuns and your brothers and sisters in the farm and all the things that I blamed the way my life was. I didn't honestly have a clue that the problem was inside myself, nor did I honestly have a clue that I could have any control over what I did. And so I left the convent, and the next 10 months I went completely to hell. They threw me into jail, which may not impress you, but after where I had been for 15 years, it surely impressed me. I told the chief of police in London that if he didn't let me out that night, right then, I was going to call the bishop. I'm sure the bishop would have been just thrilled to have a call from me. I found myself going to bars where I found people that I could relate to. I began drinking with lower companions, and it wasn't long before I was the lower companion. I was saying last night I began drinking with bank presidents and industrial giants, but they probably went home and said, too, God, you know this woman at the bar last night, she was drinking and she was telling us she's an ex-nun. They probably didn't believe that either. Well, at the end of that time, my brother came to fetch me out of 999 Queen Street, which you all know what that is, and it, I guess, gives you an indication of how sick I was that I didn't want to leave. I was institutionalized, and I was safe there. I wasn't big on making decisions and taking responsibility for myself. The discrepancy between what I wanted my life to be and what I saw myself to be, there was a vast chasm between those two. I felt like a loser. I felt like a victim. I felt like somebody who didn't have the power to do the things that she wanted to do. And in the insane asylum, I was saner than most of them in there. And so I didn't want to leave. My brother, however, took me to Saskatoon, where I met the man who was to become my husband, a psychiatrist, wouldn't you know. I don't think he had his loafers too tightly on either, because while I was still a patient, he invited me out and I accepted. And so began a very bizarre relationship, as you can imagine, between a drunken ex-nun and a drunken psychiatrist. My friend from California says, their neuroses were complementary. The rocks in his head fit the holes in hers. Somehow or other, people always find that rather humorous, probably because there's a ring of truth in it. Well, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for 5.5 years, and I was in Prince Albert, and that's why Al and I had a lot of catching up to do, because we know many of the same people. And, you know, those people 12-stepped me and brought me into the meetings, and I sat there in those meetings for 5.5 years, stoned out of my mind on drugs. And I remember they even let me go out to the women's jail for 2 years. I thought I was carrying the message. I was probably carrying the disease. But eventually I stayed away from meetings because I was ashamed of what I was. Not the fact that I was an alcoholic. I was ashamed of the way I was living. And I knew that there I wasn't fulfilling what the big book said. And so I stopped going to meetings. And I never want that experience again, because it isn't too long from the time I stopped going to meetings, from the time I started talking about alcoholics as those people. And once I started talking about alcoholics as those people, it wasn't long before I was drunk. By this time I was married. We were living in Timmins. Some of you may have 12-stepped me, for all I know. I can remember on several occasions waking up out of a blackout and there'd be somebody beside the bed and I would have called them. And just for Gareth's sake, I will tell you the story of the baby dolls. I don't very often tell this story anymore because I've kind of forgotten about it. But my husband was away on a conference and so I didn't have to hide booze in the bedroom. And one morning I woke up about 3 o'clock in the sweats and shaking and I needed a drink. And at that point the wind blew in the window, slammed the door shut, and something happened to the lock, and I couldn't get out. And the housekeeper wasn't there, so there was nobody around. So I took a look, and I thought, I've got to get out of here. I need a drink. I was up about a story and a half. The only way out was the window. So I looked out, and it was a long ways down. And I thought, well, I'll throw out a chair, and then I'll jump on the chair. Which is what I did. I threw out the chair, and as, thank goodness, the chair sort of flopped away, and I jumped down. I broke my foot in the process, but of course it was several days till I realized that because I was plastered. I ran around, now I have the problem getting into the house. The booze is in the house downstairs, and I've got to get in there. And sometime before I'd seen, there was a little property and had a little stable, and there was a big ox goad on it. The ox goad was about as long as I was tall and probably as wide, and it was kind of heavy. So I went out about 6 feet long, and here I am. And the house was on sort of a hill. And there I am, 85 pounds, soaking wet in my baby dolls, and taking flying leaps at the back door, trying to break it down. I should have had you there, Al. You would have been a great assistant. So eventually, I just got a rock and smashed in the window. There was a round window at the top. The glass went flying. I went downstairs, got a drink, phoned the police, and said that somebody had been trying to break in and that I had just, because I was very guilty about the fact that there was alcohol in my breath, said that I had just taken a drink to calm my nerves, and they thought I was very brave, and I went on with this idea, and they patrolled the property for 3 days. And then came May the 18th, 1973. I don't remember the last 10 days that I was on the face of the earth. I had gone to Cincinnati, to Cleveland, to Saskatoon, to Rosetown, to Prince Albert. I lost my car in Prince Albert. How you lose your car, I don't know, but it took the RCMP 6 weeks to find it. And finally I went back to Toronto and found myself in a psych ward in London, Ontario, with two little men sitting at the foot of the bed, and they really were there. One was a private detective, and one was a psychiatrist. And little did I know that within 2 days, my life was to change drastically, because on Sunday morning, as I sat in that bed, I had a spiritual awakening. And I realized for the first time in my life what was really wrong with me. Up to that time, I was 40 years of age, and I had not a clue about how things worked in this world. I understood that morning that I had a problem with alcohol and I had a problem with pills, but that wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back. What I really understood was that we were bankrupt. And that's what did it to me. You know, Al said the other night it was, for him it was the little girl saying, "There goes the drunk." For me, I realized we were bankrupt, and as long as I had a visible means of support, as long as I had somebody to lean on, you know, you may wonder why I'm so het on this thing that I've got to take responsibility for myself and, you know, not try to listen to everybody. I did that all my life and it didn't work. I leaned on people. I tried to get other people to make solutions for me and they never could make solutions for me. And I think it's born out of this kind of experience because I had no more money and I realized the house was financed. All the show and all that nonsense was just that. It was a big bag of wind. And so I said to myself, how am I going to look after myself? And all the options that came to mind were not acceptable to me, and so I said, I'm going to stop drinking, and I'm going to put the pills away, and I'm going to try life cold sober. And you know, right at that moment, the compulsion to drink left me, and it has never returned. I left that hospital that afternoon, and I went home. My husband was still drinking. There was more booze around our house than I had ever seen. And it was no temptation to me. It's no credit to me. God removed from me that moment, because I believe I was totally willing to be sober. He removed the compulsion. And I believe when I'm totally willing to be anything, and when I follow that up with the appropriate action, God lets the power flow. I believe that today. I believe all the love in the universe is within me. All the power is within me. All the life is within me. Because God is within me. And the only problem I ever have is if I will not let what is inside me flow out. If I keep it dammed up, or if I keep it in there because of my negative thinking, or because of my belief that people are my answer. People are my answer, but people who represent the power of God, which is what I think these meetings are all about. Not people who have answers in themselves, as I used to believe. And so I went through Dawnwood, and, you know, I have no opinions on treatment centers. I'm just grateful that it was there for me. It was an intervention. It got me out of the situation that I was in. They put a few new ideas into my head. They started to tell me that maybe my husband was not my problem. And so out I went. It was there that I met one person who was to be very influential in my life. I don't know him very well, but on two occasions, he set my feet exactly where they should be. I think I've indicated to you how sick I was. You know, I had had a go with the Jesuits and the Mother Superiors and the Sister Superiors and the psychiatrists and psychologists and doctors and nurses and anybody who would listen to me to whine and complain and analyze why I was the way I am. I think it's Clancy who says, you know, if you're sitting on the, if the Titanic goes down, there are some people who will row away. Me, I sat on the deck saying, I'll row away when I figure out why the ship is going down. And you see, it never got me any place. So I came to the point where there were people in my life who pointed my feet in the right direction. I was out of the institution about 3 weeks when one night I thought I was seriously contemplating suicide. And I went to the institution the next morning and I asked for Dr. Maharaj and he took me in. He was the resident psychiatrist there. And he really had my number because he said to me, I hear you wanted to commit suicide last night. And I said, yes. Thinking we were going to have a long chit-chat about my childhood and about my parents and how they didn't bring me up right and so on. He said, I just have one thing to say to you, Mildred. He said, if you want to commit suicide, that's what you have to do. And if you want to get well, I'll help you. And that was the gist of the conversation. He said, I'll give you my phone number. And he said, if you want to call me at any time, I'm here to help you. And I tell you, it's possible to get well. You don't have to continue the way you were. And that was the end of the conversation. And I thought, he really is a most insensitive man. However, I knew he had my number. About a year and a half later, I again had a teaching job. And instead of doing what I had done all my life, which was teach grade 12 and 13 in college English, I was teaching emotionally disturbed adolescents. And I suppose you can see there's a divine irony there. And I should have been very good at it, having had such a great deal of experience, but I didn't know how to teach kids like that. So I went back to him, and I said to him, you know, I'm feeling very incompetent. He said, that's probably because you are. And, you know, I didn't take that as a down put, and he didn't mean it as a down put. All he was saying was, I cannot give you self-esteem. If you want to feel good about yourself, and I think that's where it all starts, and that's what this is all about. And that's why, as Paul said, we love the hell out of each other. And that's really what it's all about. It was the love of people like yourselves that I first got an inkling that I was okay and that I could be okay. All he was saying was, if you don't know what you're doing, then go do something about it. Go get yourself back to university and get the information you need or whatever so that you can function at a level where you feel competent. You see, all my life I wanted somebody to say, you know, Mildred, you're such a good girl. And at one point in my life, if you fluffed up my ego, I would go home and I would feel okay for a little while. But there comes a time when you gotta face yourself, at least when I had to face myself, and that didn't work anymore. I know today that if I want to feel good about myself, I have got to do the things that I have to do so that I can feel good about myself. There's nothing worse in my life than procrastinating. If I've got things to do or things that are troubling me, I know today that those have got to be on the head of the list of things to do because nothing takes the place, not even prayer. I've tried that. You know, if I feel lousy inside or I'm feeling a little nervous about something I have to do inside, and I think, gee, you know, I'll have a little chat with God, and God's going to fix all this. God can't fix it unless I fix it myself, and so the things I want to do least are the ones that have to go on top of the list. And that's what that man was trying to get to me. I think basically all life is, the good life is based on discipline. I can't think of a good life that doesn't, well, we talk about it in the program, don't we? We say principles before personalities. When I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me about 6 months after I went through Donwood, because after I got through Donwood, I used to go back to the aftercare, and at some point I realized, I'm not changing. This isn't what it's all about. They didn't insist on continuous sobriety. And that 5.5 years I'd had in AA had told me that continuous sobriety, continuous growth, continuous change is what it's all about. And so I walked back into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous because I simply wasn't, I had no friends, we had no money, and I needed companionship. And so I went back to AA. And I would come to the meetings and I'd sit near the back and there was always somebody to say hello, and finally I got hooked on what was in these rooms. I didn't come back here because I believed in God or because I believed in a power greater than myself or because I believed there was anything that was going to solve my problems. I just simply came back here because I knew it was one place where we'd be accepted. My husband and I were not in terribly great shape. You know, we sat there one time and we figured out that between us we had 7 degrees and 44 years of formal schooling. Sure doesn't say much about formal education, does it? Somebody once pointed out to me what the relationship of degrees and rectal thermometers, so I don't say that too often anymore. We had two dogs. And those two dogs loved us unconditionally. And I had those two dogs put to sleep. And I had those two dogs put to sleep because I didn't know what else to do with them. We had no money. We were poverty stricken. I know what it's like to not have money. And for me, that was an ego deflation in depth. And I am deeply grateful for it because I found out that first year what life is really all about and what is important and what is not. I learned that love is important. I didn't know that that's what I was learning. I learned that life is important. I learned that you really have only one crack at this thing, and that it's not like a VCR that you can put it on hold till you feel like participating again. It just goes flitting by, and if I waste the minutes, they're gone, and so I'd better enjoy them. I learned that it was possible to enjoy life with no money in my pocket and with old clothes on my back. It didn't matter. People loved me because I was me, not because I had a title or I had property or whatever things we sometimes think are so very important. I can think back to my first year of sobriety. I had not a clue where I was going. I think if I ever lived one day at a time, I did it that first year I was sober, and it was the most beautiful experience of my life. I remember having to take the TTC, and I can remember sitting on the subway with the tears rolling down my cheeks. They weren't tears of self-pity, and they weren't tears of anger. They were tears of sheer and utter joy at being alive. And I always want to remember that because it was a powerful experience. And I remember the day that I took the letter to the vet to put the dogs down. And I think from that day something happened inside myself, because up to that day I had lived by feelings. I think feelings are wonderful as long as they are mastered by principle. But if all you've got is feelings and no principle, it's like horses that are out of line and that you can't control. I remember a little man who used to come to our meetings that first year, and he used to say, "Do the do things." Doesn't sound very impressive, does it? But I hung on to that thing, and sometimes when I get confused at 15 years of sobriety, the words come back to me. What he said, do the do things. All he was trying to tell me was, don't wait till you feel good. You know, if I had waited to feel good, that's the beauty of this program. I think that's what the steps are all about. The steps don't say, well, you know, when you think over these steps and you've got them all analyzed and you know what the steps are all about, then you do them. I don't see any reason why you can't do the steps in your first days of sobriety. There's nothing in the big book that says you can't do the steps 15 times round if you want to do them. You know, I, at that point, think back to what that little man said. Do the do things. It reminds me of the story of the kitten. The kitten was seen to be chasing its tail madly, going around in a circle trying to catch his tail. And the old tomcat came out of the weeds. And he said to him, what are you doing, you silly little cat, chasing your tail like that? Don't you know? And the little kitten said, I found that my happiness is in my tail. Sounds rude, doesn't it? Especially for a Sunday morning meeting. And the old tomcat said, don't you know, you silly little kitten? He said, all you have to do is walk straight ahead and your happiness will follow along behind you. And I think that's what do the do things is all about. You don't wait till you feel good to do the things you ought to do, because it never happens. It's not thinking my way into feeling good. It's acting my way into feeling good. As Paul said, you know, dear old Chuck, who said, what is love? It's action. You see, that's where I think some of our modern psychologists go astray, and I'm not here to criticize them, but sometimes, and I've read, and I still do, I read a lot of these self-help books. How can I make my life work better, and how can I make it more successful? But, you know, where they leave you flat, because they leave you with yourself. And that's where the program takes us. The program takes us beyond self. I have a right to be well. I have a right to feel good. I have a right to hold my head high because God doesn't make junk. He made me out of himself. And I'm precious, and I have my footprints to leave on the face of the earth, just as the same applies to you. I believe that you are made out of the same stuff, and you have your footprint, and neither are you junk. And so, I can't do that, though. I can't really love you unless I love myself. I used to hear what the great teacher had said, only I missed the two most important words. Thank you for being here, Humboldt. Bye-bye. I had missed what the great teacher had said, and that is that you must love your neighbor as yourself. I thought you have to love your neighbor first, and then through loving your neighbor, you learn to love yourself. I think that's kind of a half-truth, because what I have learned in the program is this. When I came to the program, and these wonderful people loved me and cared about me, something, I began to feel better about myself. I didn't come in here feeling good about you. I came in here because I felt lousy about myself. That's what I projected out on other people. I think it was Emerson who said, "We see the world not as it is, but as we are." And I think all you have to think about is a situation that you confront when you're feeling you're in love, you're full of life and enthusiasm, you're feeling good, the sun is shining, and you think the world is going your way, and something comes into your life that you don't like, you handle it, don't you? But you get up some morning and you've had a fight with the wife or your husband, and AA aren't doing things right, and the world isn't doing things right, and God hasn't given you what you want, and you're feeling ugly in here, and you go out and confront that same situation, and boy, people better watch out. And what has happened, it's not the situation that has changed, it's the attitude and it's the perception with which I attack that situation. And so, I think that loving myself has come to be very important. But again, in the context, I think that it's presented to us in the program. That's what I love about this program. The longer I'm here, the more I see how little I know. The longer I'm here, the more I see how wise the program is. Because it doesn't say here, come here and get sober for yourself. We know that if you come here and you get sober for yourself and you go away to lead your life, many people can't make it that way. I'm not going to be the experimenter who tries. I remember one time being at a meeting at which they gave out 6 months chips. And there was this man I had spoken to before the meeting. And I had thought he said that he had been around for 20 years. And when they gave out the 6 month chip, he got up and he went to the front to get a 6 month chip. So after the meeting, I went to him and I said, "I don't mean to butt into your personal business, but I said, I'm just curious. I thought you told me, did I misunderstand you, that you were around 20 years? And he said, "You bet I was." He said, "And I don't mind telling you." He said, "I was around for about 16 years, and he said, "I had a fantastic sobriety." He said, "I loved the program, I was active, and then," he said, "I got some business opportunities, and I got too busy," and he said, "I didn't really need the program anyway." And he said, "I stopped going to meetings," and he said, "You know now, that's why I went up to get the 6 month chip, because I blew away the thing that was most precious in my life. And I don't want to be the one who tries that." You see, and I think that's why the program is so wise. It recommends that we do the steps, because in the steps is health for ourselves. I fought the steps. I said to my sponsor, "I know more about this God and this, you know, this stuff, step three." He said, "You know nothing. Go home." And he said, "We'll do these steps together, and you'll find out." So, okay, I could do step one. I could admit I had my life was unmanageable. I could do two, because I'm not stupid. I know that I couldn't stay sober by myself, but that with the help of other people at the meetings, I had been sober by this time about 9 months. Step three, I thought, oh, you know, I know all about God. And he would say, go home and read the big book. And I would come back and I would tell him what I thought step three meant. And I would get into God and my life and, you know, stuff that I was totally incompetent to deal with. And one day he said, go home and read the book again. And so I came back and I said, well, I guess the most important words in that step must be to make a decision. He said, you got it, dummy. And so I made a decision that I would change, and that I would change through doing, and isn't that really what step three is all about? I made a decision that I would turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I would change the way I thought about life. I would change the way I thought about myself. I would change my attitude toward everything. Now, how do I change? Not by sitting on my rear end talking. And so he said, all right, how are you going to change? And he pointed out to me that that's what step 4 to 9 were all about. And so I did my fourth step. And I did it with some fear, I must say. Because I thought I was really the worst person in the world. And that, of course, is just a form of egotism. Because we're just, as I see it today, we're just fellow travelers. And some of us have done one thing and some of us have done another. But basically, we've all done the same kinds of things. I think it all boils down to not loving ourselves, going to the wrong source for our source of supply. Rather than looking to the Spirit, we think we're going to get our happiness, we're going to get our satisfaction from other things other than what the first commandment has told us all along. I am the Lord thy God. You must not have strange gods before me. And I think what that really is saying, and if you try to have strange gods before me, I will defeat you until you come home to where I am and until you acknowledge that I am indeed the source of your life. And I think that's really what this is all about. So anyway, I did the first 9 steps. I got to the end of step 9, and that's when I made the worst, I think, discovery of my life. Because that's when I discovered that Alcoholics Anonymous had not done for me what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was going to do for me. I was teaching at this time. I was sober, I guess, about almost 2 years. And I had finished the first 9 steps. As I was on that process, I'd say, well, I'll feel better when I do 2. I'll feel better when I get step 3 done. I'll feel better when I do step 4. Here I am. I've got the first 9 steps done. And I'm standing at school, and I haven't got a clue about how to live. Just to show you how bad I was emotional. I was moody. This is when the anger started to come out of me. Me? A nice little nun who'd never said a bad word in her life? I thought I didn't even know these words until at one point they threw me out of a hotel because I had been using such bad language in a blackout. And I didn't even know that I knew those words. And here I am, I'm sober about 1 year and 9 months, and now the anger is really starting to come out. And it came out as terrible depression, and it came out in terrible moodiness, and it came out in terrible silence, and it came out in lashings out against people that had not done anything to me. And I can remember going into school, and I used to hate this because I flattered myself that I was so cool. And I'd be sitting at my desk in school, and I'd hear one of the kids looking around the corner, and he'd shout down the corridor, and he'd say, "Stay away from this room. She's mad today." And I would die inside. And one of my colleagues, a teacher friend, one day said to me, "Listen here, you." She said, "I don't know what's going on inside you." But she said, "You say that you're an alcoholic." Well, she said, "If you don't do something about your weird behavior, there's a lot more wrong with you than alcoholism." And I didn't like that either. What she was getting at was, I didn't know how to relate to people. All my life, I thought I was a very kind person. What I was really a very self-serving person. I would be kind to you, because if I was kind to you, perhaps you would like me. It wasn't a real, genuine kindness. I think there's a great difference between genuine compassion, the tough love that we've been hearing about this weekend and that we hear about in AA, and that many people have exercised on us in AA, and the the soft, sentimental stuff. You know, that's why I changed my first sponsor. My first sponsor was terrific for me for about 4 or 5 months. She started to tell me, you've got to change. The problems are inside yourself. And then she started to agree with me. And I started to I realized I was going back down the old path. I needed somebody who would stand me up against the wall and say, look at the truth about yourself. Mac Cheater came around. Mac was a friend of mine. And Mac, I really loved him. I'm sure many of you knew Mac because he was from Winnipeg, and I'm sure you knew how gentle and how kind and what a loving man he was. You sensed that when you were in his presence. And Mac came to see me in Toronto. And it was about this time, and I said, Mac, you're just such a lovely man. I said, how can I become like you? And I tried to explain to him what was going on in my life, that I had done the program as I saw it, and that I thought, well, 10, 11, and 12, they're just to carry on from where I had been. And I said, you know, it seems to me the program is really failing me. I didn't really believe that, but I couldn't make the connection, and he helped me. He said, you do steps 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. I said, yeah, but Mac, really, what do you do? What do you read? You know, I thought, can't be that simple. He said, Mildred, you do steps 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. And I asked him once more, and he told me the same thing. And he said, Mildred, when you understand, you will understand. And about 6, 7, 8 months ago, I realized what Mac had really said. Because in the process, I'm a slow learner. Yes, I know. But what had really happened in the process, I started to try to find out how the world works. And what basically happened to me, I had to change my attitude to God, to myself, and to other people. I've already sort of indicated what has happened. I used to start talking about my relationship to others, but I think I need to tell you what I think about God to the best of my ability, and you may think this is silly. I used to believe in the God that created me and that was, after I died, was going to judge me and send me either to heaven, hell, or purgatory or whatever. I believed God could be manipulated. I believed God was like an earthly father. Sometimes he was up, sometimes he was down, sometimes he gave you what you wanted, sometimes he didn't. And it was all really totally incomprehensible. I couldn't understand how God could send you suffering and pain and still be a good God. I don't believe today that God sends us suffering and pain. I think it's a little bit like the wind. I've never seen the wind either, but I know a whole lot about the wind because I look at what the wind does. And I think if I want to know about God, even though I don't see God, I can look at what God does in this world and how he acts, and then I know some things. And another analogy I like, I think God is like gravity. I think gravity, we get up in the morning and we don't really think about it, we just know it's there. And you know that gravity is going to act in a totally predictable manner, and you know it's going to treat all alike. And I think that's the way God is. He acts in a totally predictable manner. No more do I have to say, well, God, you do this and you do that. I know how things are going to turn out. If I want radishes, I have no power to make the radishes grow, but my share in that is to plant the seed, till the soil, water the ground, put fertilizer there if I have to, pull out the weeds, and then let the process, the miracle, take place. And I think that's how God works in the world. If the sun can't send darkness, then how can a God who is good send pain? Sure, I've had pain in my life, but where has the pain come from? It's come from the exercise of my own self-will, wanting things the way I want instead of living in this world the way I believe it is today. I believe it's a world of cause and effect. If I do the right things, if I cooperate with the power within me, then I'm going to get good effects. And if I don't cooperate with the power within me, and I think Paul was hinting at that last night when he said, we generate so much love. Of course we do, because God is within us and God is love. And if I don't let that love flow, then something weird, something abnormal starts to take place, and I become a twisted, bent human being. And so if I let the love flow, then I'm okay, and I believe that's what it's all about, my cooperating with God, and the more I cooperate and the more I allow to flow, the happier I'm going to be. And that's where the beauty of the program is, because that's what step 12 says. You see, I think if I'm going to do step 10, which is assess what's going on in my life, it really has to flow from step 11, because I'm not a unit unto myself. To know who I am, I have to know who God is and what my relationship to that loving Father is. And if I'm going to get along with you, I have to know how you fit. I used to feel people were a threat. God, I hated women. Not men so much, because I sort of wanted to be a man, but I hated women because I thought women were my competition. How silly. Who's my competition? There's no such thing. My footprints are my footprints. Your footprints are your footprints. And we're each entitled to our own footprints. You're not supposed to be like me, and you're probably saying, thank God for that. And I'm not supposed to be like you. I'm supposed to weave my way through this world, and I'm supposed to be myself. You see, what I have found out, too, is this. That if I try to be like other people, and if I look at you and say, gee, he's done that, why can't I do that? And if I look at somebody else and I, you know, think, what happened? One of two things. I either feel superior or I feel inferior, and neither one is correct. The way I see it today, we're just fellow travelers. A couple of months ago, I sat overlooking the Gulf of Mexico one Sunday morning, and I remembered something that I had read that I'd like to pass on, and what it said was that waves are simply the ocean in different sizes, shapes, heights, etc. That each wave can be entitled to be called the ocean, and I believe that each one of us is entitled to call ourselves, in a manner of speaking, God, because we came from him. We're just different shapes. We're in different process of growth. That's all. And so that's how I think God works with me. And instead of my being so busy trying to find out what everybody else wants me to do, I've got to try and listen to the voice of God. Because I think it's a still small voice. And if I've learned anything in these 15 years, it's this. I can't please you. There's no point even trying. I can become quite crazy if I look out over that crowd and think, gee, I wonder what they'd like me to say. I wonder what would really make me popular with them. Or you look at any situation in life, and you try to mold your behavior to what you think other people will want to do. Have you ever tried it? Are you successful? You may think temporarily that you're a great hit, and then you find out that they're chit-chatting behind your back, and that you didn't get the promotion you thought you were going to get, and that they don't like you so well anyway. And I have found out that the greatest thing I have today is the ability to go to bed and put my head on the pillow and being able to say, you know, Mildred, you're not such a bad kid after all. I kind of like you. I wasn't taught that. I was taught we should have humility. And if you had proper humility, you didn't think that you were a good person. Well, all I can say today is, if it's true that God made me, and if he didn't, then I'm in trouble. If he made me, then I must be made out of the same stuff that he is, and I don't believe he makes junk. So why shouldn't I feel good about myself? And if I'm trying to do the best that I can to listen to the spirit within me and do the right things, why shouldn't I feel good about myself? I'm not perfect, but I'm not the person I was either, and I've made a lot of progress. And I believe today that I am everything that I can be. And I believe the same about you, wherever you're sitting in this business of living. You know, you think, well, people should make better decisions. I haven't got any idea. I can only look at myself and tell you that in some ways I have done some very terrible things. I can remember, this being Mother's Day, my mother is dead, but I can remember cutting that woman to shreds. And why? Because she cared about me. One day, I was on my way back to London, Ontario, and she said to me, Mildred, we don't even have your address. I was flitting in and out of a blackout, and she's caring about me. She said, you could die in the streets, and we'd even never know that you were dead. And she said, where are you going to be living? And I remember looking at her, and I said, what business is that of yours? I've had about enough of the meddling in this family trying to keep me sober. If I want to drink, I'll drink. And I remember the tears streaming down her cheeks, and her sitting there sobbing. And I thought, what's the matter with her? This is my life, and I'll do with it what I want. So, you know, I can look back, and I've done some terrible things. But the fact is, At that time, that was the only response that I could make, given where I was. There's no point my sitting here today and trying to judge what I did 10 years ago by what I know today. Today is a new, fresh day, and the only thing that I can live with and respond with is what I know today and not feel guilty because I didn't use today's values and today's attitudes to solve yesterday's problems. And once I understand that, that's another chain that's been lifted from me. And I know that I can go forward. So I've had to learn to listen to that wee small voice inside. You know, that's been quite a task because I don't like to be quiet. And I love the way Paul described the voices. The psychologists call it root brain chatter, and it's always going on there. My senses like to see, and my hands and skin likes to feel, and my nose likes to smell, and my mouth likes to taste, and the eyes like to see, and the ears like to hear. And the whole thing doesn't like to shut down. And yet, if I'm going to hear the still small voice inside me, which is really the only voice that counts, I've got to be quiet. And I think probably in the last year, I have acquired a little bit of facility. And to me, that's where peace is really found. I think if you want to grow a big tree, it's got to have roots. You know, we can come to these meetings, and God knows these meetings are wonderful, and I couldn't live without them. But the fact still remains, I've got to go home from these meetings. What do I do if I have not put myself together? And that's what my sponsor said to me. He said, Mildred, you've got to do the steps. If you don't want to do the steps, he said, I'm not going to sponsor you. Because he said, I can't carry you and I won't carry you. I won't take responsibility for you. And I won't even take control of you. But he said, you will do the steps. Because you've got to go home and you've got to live inside your own skin. And that to me is the most precious gift that I've gotten here, is the feeling that I am no longer alone. It's wonderful to be here and to be with all you loving people, but it's also wonderful to go home and to sit in my apartment and be alone, or to go wherever I am, to go inside myself and remember that the Spirit truly lives within me, and that's really what counts. And it's given me some freedom from fear. Not total, but if I remember that people have no power to hurt me, and people have no power to help me either, so I can stop manipulating. Because I believe truly that if I keep the principles of this program, my life is going to be okay. Does that mean that nothing's ever going to go wrong? Uh-uh. Sure, there's pain. What is pain all about? I think personally that I can only speak for myself. I used to concentrate far too much on pain and suffering and talk about it. That was the evidence of the problem. I didn't want to do anything about the problem. I didn't want to get on to the solution. It's easier to talk about how I'm feeling and what's wrong and who's wrong and all that kind of stuff. Or lie on the psychiatrist's couch. That's a good one. And you know, analyze why you are the way you are. But eventually, I find out that it doesn't do any good. That the only thing that really helps me is to recognize if I'm in pain, there's something wrong with me. And my second sponsor taught me that. He said, I will sponsor you if you will agree to this. I said, what's that? He said that if you're upset, you admit that you're wrong and that it's not the rest of the world, but something is wrong with you. And I thought that was pretty tough medicine. But you know, as I sat out at the jail the other night, I am talking about the people, not the people who patted me on the back and said, sweetheart, we know how you're suffering. If it had happened to me, I know I'd feel just the same. I'm telling you about the people who dealt me some severe blows and who told me the way the truth really was, that if I wanted a good life, then it was I that was going to have to change, and it wasn't the rest of the world that was wrong. And so I have, I think, a sense of dignity today. I have a sense of self-respect. I'm not always pleased with what I do. You know, and I think there are stresses in life, and I'll tell you what I do with stress. Sometimes I go home and go to bed. You ever get a day like that where everything, every move you make, you just seem to be irritated by other people, and you irritate them? And then you come home and there's mail and there are unwarranted bills and you've got everything's going wrong. And, you know, on a day like that, my adrenaline can really pump and the old ego gets up and I think, boy, I'm going to go after this one and I'm going to go after that one. You know what I found is a good solution to a day like that? Go home, have a good meal, have a bath, and go to bed. And now think about it. And you may say, but isn't that a cop-out? Well, maybe it is a cop-out. I don't know. But I just know if I keep on at that in that way, I'm going to get right back into the old rut of trying to change people, places, and things, and it doesn't work. Whereas if I go to bed and have a good night's sleep and a good rest, try to meditate, maybe read a spiritual book, or watch a giddy television program if that's what turns you on, all that anxiety and anguish and all that stuff goes. Next morning I can tackle it, and you know, half the things, three-quarters of the things, 90% of the things aren't as bad as I thought they were. I have been able to put God back in God's seat, and Mildred is back where she belongs, and everything sort of works its way out eventually. You know, all pain is really telling me, I believe, is that I have to change, that there's something in my attitude that's wrong and that I really need to do something about. And so how do I get along with other people today? Well, infinitely better than I used to, because I'm starting to like people. It came as a shock to me, because to cover up everything that was going on inside, people used to say, oh, but you're such an extrovert. Uh-huh. You get along so well with people. Uh-huh. But I had so many walls around me, nobody really knew me, because I had built it that way. I orchestrated my life so that nobody would get to know me. What I'm finding is I'm letting the shield down gradually. I'm becoming more adaptable to other people and to their needs and to the way they are, and less judgmental, because I realize about myself, even though you may not like what I do, you may think I'm wrong, according to where I'm standing, I'm doing the best I can. And if that's the way it is with me, why shouldn't I give you the same feeling and the same approach to life? You see, I think it's all sort of bundled up in what the great teacher told us. He said, give and it shall be given to you. That's AA philosophy, isn't it? He also said, if you want to be forgiven, you must forgive others. And you mustn't judge. Judge and you will not be judged. Isn't that simple? Don't condemn others. Why not? Because if I'm doing the best I can, I have to believe you are too. You don't see the world the way I do, and why should you? You are a unique individual and living your life from where you are. And I just want to talk just a little bit about forgiveness, because I've had a little situation in my life on forgiveness. And I think really forgiveness is the crux of almost everything. When you know what you think about forgiveness, you know what you think about life. You know what you think about yourself, you know what you think about others, and you know what you think about God. I went to a dinner party about 2 years ago, and I was in one of those periods in my life where I was feeling kind of low. My self-esteem needed a little fluffing up. And we were going to this dinner party with my gentleman friend, and we were going to see friends that had been my friends since we were in the program. You have to bear in mind that I've always had this feeling that men have the advantage in life. I mean, you understand, that's the way I was programmed. That men were the lucky ones and that women would never amount to anything. And I'll tell you, that message has gone very deep in me. I'm getting over it, but anyway. We go to this dinner party and I'm expecting it's just going to be a nice little love-in. And instead, these two men sitting on both ends of the table, they got to talking business, and they ignored me. Can you imagine such a situation? They ignored me, and they're talking business. They didn't need my opinion. And as I'm sitting there, the wheels are starting to turn. See, I was right all along. They don't care. I'm just a stupid woman. See, listen to what they're talking about. And the face got longer, and the smile wiped off my face. And by the time we left the dinner table to go and sit in front of the fire, I had reverted to my old personality. And my old way of handling a situation that I couldn't control was to crawl into myself with a face this long and feel sorry for myself. So they put the fire on, and by this time a few tears are rolling down. Somebody says to me, what's wrong with you? Oh, nothing. Oh, nothing. They chit-chatted a little while, and then Kevin started asking me about AA. And I thought, see, I'm good enough to talk about all this silly humanistic stuff, but nobody talks business to me. And I just, you know, you couldn't have pleased me at that time. And I started to cry. And eventually we went home, and I went into a depression. You know, I think that often the things that are happening right here, they're often not things about what is happening right here. They've got relationship to things. This was the message that I had had all my life. You're no good. You're a woman. And all this kind of stuff. That's what was causing it. It wasn't just that dinner party. And I had gone to that dinner party wanting human beings to fluff up my self-esteem. I'd gone right back to where I was. So, I was angry. I was really angry at Kevin. And I tried to forgive. And eventually, I went back to all the things that I knew that the great teacher had said, and I would pray and I would meditate, and I would say, Kevin, I fully and freely forgive you, and I want to be free of this, and I would feel okay. Now, I'm going to cut this short because time is going, but I found that I had to do that for about a year and a half. I've heard people say, you forgive once, if you've really forgiven, it's finished, and I guess if you've reached the point of real forgiveness. But with me, the problem was, I had forgiven, but then something, you know, the memory of it was still there. And when the memory of it was resurrected, the old feeling was resurrected, and I was again feeling unloving and bitter over that situation. And what I found was I had to keep working at it and working at it and working at it until one day I said it. I said, I fully and freely forgive you, and I felt as if the dam had burst. Because I knew that I had fully and freely forgiven, because I had recognized that again I had been expecting of people what I should only expect from the spirit within, the feeling that I am okay. That has been a big change in my life. It has opened up a whole wealth of things, because I think sometimes in our growth, something, life takes an orderly process. You don't get the rose on the little bush, do you? The bush has to grow first, and then you get the blooming rose. God knows what he's doing. I think God works through a natural process. And for me, that process had to go on before I could let go some of the other things and become a kinder person. I used to act kind. I think I am a lot kinder now. I'm kinder in my thoughts. I'm less judgmental. And you know, isn't it funny how God puts into our lives what we need? I have had two sponsors, and I have another sponsor now. And I sat down with this third sponsor, because I think we grow. People sometimes, it's like in marriage, two people don't always grow in the same direction and at the same speed. And I think sometimes people in the program, we don't grow, and that doesn't mean I'm ahead of him or he's ahead of me. It doesn't mean that. I needed a new sponsor. And so I talked to this man, and what did he tell me? His three great beliefs, and they're just exactly what I need. He said, every problem that you come up against with, or a philosophy of life, this is what he says, don't resist it. Don't resist it, approach it with fearless faith, and love it. And I've learned that love, if I can do it, love is the answer to everything. Love will solve your negative emotions. Love will solve your negative thinking. Love will solve the pumping of adrenaline. Love will make everything okay. I tried it. One night I had an experience about which I was very angry. This was about 6 months ago. And I remembered what Bob had said. Love it. You see, once the adrenaline is there, the energy is there. And the energy has got to do something. So there was this situation that I didn't like. And I didn't even know how to do it, and I really don't quite know how to do it, except I know it works. And I said to that situation, I don't like you, but I love you. You are here in my life for some reason, and I'm going to learn from you. And you know what? I went out that night. My girlfriend and I were going to the symphony, and I had a beautiful evening. And I tried that, and that's why I want to pass it on. If the energy is there, use the energy for love, even though you don't quite know. God, who is love, who lives within you, He knows, and He knows how to fix all things and how to set all things right. And now I'll close with a little story that somebody has asked me to close with because they like it and I like it. And it's the little story of the man who was going down the road in Java. And I guess the reason I like the story, because it symbolizes the whole philosophy of AA. We've got it all here. Let's appreciate it and believe and trust that we really have it. You know, I guess before we go, I should just say this. Are you thrilled about going home? If you're new in the program, I often think of this when we come to this point. Because when I was young in the program, and I'm not that old in the program, but when I was a year or two sober, I used to love conferences, but I hated going back home because all my problems were there. This was so lovely, you know, we were eating out and we were having a good time and talking and laughing and you know, I didn't really have to think. But back home, I knew there were things that I didn't want to confront. Just stop and think for a minute. What is it back there that you don't want to confront? Is there a person at your job that you don't really like? Is there a situation at your work that really troubles you? Or is it a sick child? Or is it somebody in your family that is in trouble? Whatever it is, maybe we should just take a little time and remember that whatever that person or whoever that person is, they haven't had the benefit of the love and kindness that has been showered on us this weekend. And maybe what we should do instead of expecting them to love us, love them. Send the light ahead of you, the light of God and the light of life and the love of, in your heart. And maybe that situation can be corrected. Anyway, this man went down the road, and as he was going down the road, he looked behind him, and he spied this very beautiful girl. She was just absolutely ravishing. And he said to her, just that, you're so ravishing and so beautiful. He said, be mine. And she said, I'm really impressed with what you're saying. But she said, you know, my younger sister is behind me, and she's even more beautiful than I am. And he looked. And there behind the first girl was indeed a younger sister coming along, but she was the most ugly, misshapen creature that he had ever seen. And in a fit of anger, he said to this first girl, you deceived me. And she said, and you deceived me. If you really thought that I was the most beautiful girl in the world, why did you look around? God bless you.